Welcome to episode 4 of the Asia Pacific Career Development Association Season 4 podcast, Career Journeys. I'm Felicity Brown, an intercultural career and leadership coach from Australia, and with me is Ruchira Tripathi, my co-host from Singapore. Hi, Ruchira.
Hi, Felicity. Hello, everybody. I'm so thrilled to be here today speaking to you with our fantastic guest.
And I'd like to welcome our guest for the episode, Hung Dung. Hung is a 2023 Obama Scholar at Columbia University in New York City and a 2022 Yale World Fellow. She's also the founder of Hopebox, a social enterprise supporting women who have experienced gender-based violence, and is the executive director of the Australia-Vietnam Leadership Dialogue. It's a very impressive resume by any measure, but even more so for a young woman from a humble background. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Hung to our podcast today, and I can't wait to hear about your career journey. Welcome, Hung.
Hi, Felicity. Hi, Ruchira. Thank you so much for your invitation.
We're very happy to have you, and we're really interested to hear about your inspiring story. So we've got a few questions. Are you ready?
Yes.
Lovely. So what we want to hear first is a bit more of who you are, like as a person, like deep down, what drives you?
My name is Hung Dung. As you guys have heard in the introduction, as a person, professionally, you know who I am, but personally, I am a proud auntie of three nieces, who gave me a lot of motivation to work and create impact, especially for women and girls. I love cookings, I love readings, I love playing pianos. I just finished my first ever half marathon in New York, and I'm about to heading out to Vietnam. So I'm a very simple person, having lots of interest in life, love my life every single day.
All right, lovely. Well, let's hear a little bit about your current roles. I mentioned some of them in the introduction, but tell us a bit more about what you do and who you work with and what problems you solve.
I wear several hats. I just completed my Obama Scholar Program at Columbia University in the city of New York. And with the Obama Foundation as well, I have been spending the last 9 months was a really transformative experience for me, having the opportunity to study at an Ivy League university, but also having a lot of resources and being given so much opportunities, not just to, you know, shake hands with President Obama or, you know, being at high level events, but learning so much from my peers and my professors and my classmates, and visiting a lot of exciting organizations, really great organizations that are doing really great work in New York. And so the work at, you know, the work at Hopebox is focusing more on creating jobs, creating opportunity, delivering training in baking for women who are victims, survival, and at risk of gender-based violence. And then also I have another job at Australia-Vietnam Leadership Dialogue, which I really like. I love my organization, but it's always great to work for Australia. I always call Australia is home for me. So being connected with an organization that is doing an amazing work in providing leadership training for young leaders of Australia and Vietnam, delivering a high level like in digital economy and providing training and competition for high school students in Vietnam to learn more about SDGs, UN sustainable goals, to tackle a lot of pressing problems. So for us, focusing more on youth development is really important. And the organization is based in Australia. And so my work usually focuses a lot on fundraising, grant writing, recruiting young leaders, delivering program, working with our steering committee volunteers and our board of directors and advisors on those projects to make sure that whatever we do is trying to bring opportunities for young leaders, for young people, and also to strengthen the bilateral relationship between Australia and Vietnam in several sectors, in trade and investment, in diplomacy, education. So that's what I'm doing. But it seems I do a lot, but I usually try to really focus on utilize my skills and also my networks and my resources as well. So those are the two things I'm really focusing now in HopeBox and ABLD.
That sounds really interesting, Hong. To put all of this in context, because when you were telling us about HopeBox, I was also thinking, what was your motivation behind starting it? And some of these other things that you're doing, I mean, what are some of these linkages that kind of led you to your work today? So could you share a little bit about your story?
Long story short, I was born in a small village of Vietnam in extreme poverty, and I was raised by my mom, who is a hero to me. And at the age of 6 years old, I love readings. I love being at school, and I always dived myself into books and magazines. My mom was never able to really buy me new books for school. So all she had to do is run around every summer, run around the village to borrow secondhand books. And I stayed with my uncles a lot, and he was a teacher back then, and he brought me a lot of magazines and books from the library. So I love readings, and I always dreamed to become a literacy teacher. That dream has never come true because of poverty. So I left school at the age of 12 when I finished year 7. And at the age of 13, I went to the city of Hanoi by myself. And my first job was a babysitter, looking after a 4-month-old baby. And I was a baby myself back then. When I reached, 16, 17 years old, the norms in the countryside is that you have to, if you are a girl, you have to go back to the countryside, getting married to someone you don't know, having kids, working on the farm. So that is a cycle of a woman. That's the life of all the women. I saw it, and somehow I decided that wasn't my life. So I stayed back in Hanoi and tried to go back to school. So I went back to an informal educational training center, and I did my year 7, my year 8, and throughout to high school. So the family that I lived with and worked for, they wasn't very nice. So they kicked me out. I didn't have any friends. I didn't have any families in the city, but I didn't want to go back to the countryside because I knew that that would be the end of my educational journey. So I stayed back in Hanoi, and I found a job, couldn't find any job. I ended up being quite homeless, didn't have any place to live, and I lived under a staircase. So every morning I cook sticky rice and sold it on the street, earning very little money to try to both support my families and also paying for my school. Life was obviously so rough. Every day was a survival day. And one day I met a classmate in my class, in my night class. And she told me about KOTO. At the beginning, I didn't really understand what that meant, but the only response I gave her was, "No, I'm not going anywhere because I can't trust anybody." 2 months later, I couldn't know where to go next. So I ended up asking her, "Can you give me the address? I want to check it out." So I went to see KOTO. It's the first social enterprise in Vietnam that helps stricken and disadvantaged youth to have hospitality training, English, and life skill training. So that's how my life completely changed. My family was changed. My community was changed because of that one opportunity that I was given. So I came to KOTO. I studied hospitality alongside my high school. When I graduated from KOTO, I worked for the hotel, Intercontinental Hotel Group. And I always thought that that was my first job only. That was a stepping stone for me to earn money and go and do my university degree. I love education and always wanted to set a high bar for my education journey. So I came back to KOTO and worked, and then I got a scholarship to study in Australia. And I was being able to complete my Master of Entrepreneurship and Innovation. And in 2017, I decided to come home to Vietnam because I wanted to work for Coto to give back to the organization that helped change my life. And during the time when I studied in Australia, I found out that my sister was a victim of domestic violence. So I have two daughters. So I could every day imagine that my nieces grew up in that environment. How are they going to be, growing up and being healthy in the community and become the women that that we wanted them to be, and they wanted to pursue the dreams that in the future would present if they witness all of that violence. So that was a really, really sad story, but that also the story of Hope Box, how it started. From the story of my sister, I learned so much about the issues, and I was shocked for many times trying to rescue my own sister all the way from Australia, and then couldn't really help her because whatever I help her financially or consultation, it still seems that it still led her back to her situation. She couldn't leave. Every time when she left, it ended up still. She went back to the village. And then I've learned that the probably the best way or the most suitable way is to give her a job. So I called her one day. I said to her, "Look, I have this idea to help the women who are victims of domestic violence. Do you want to work with me?" And she said yes. So that how we started setting up a project is a very humble program, and then it's become the first social enterprise in Vietnam that helps this group of women.
That's such an inspiring story, Huong. And when you were sharing, I mean, it basically eventually led up to Hope Box, but when you were sharing about you leaving home, actually I have a similar story like that in my family as well. And I was thinking that, it's always the first person who's brave enough to, take that first step that kind of changes the trajectory of the entire family. For me, it was my grandfather who did that. And if he didn't, I would be my life would be really different. So it's something incredible. I mean, not something that you've just done for yourself, but also for the people who come after you, potentially. So I want to also ask you about your childhood heroes. You mentioned a little bit about the tough childhood that you had. You mentioned it in brief, but did you have any childhood heroes or people that you looked up to when you were growing up?
This is a great question. I would separate it in a different phase. As a 6 years old, my uncle was a hero. In that small village where no one prioritized education, especially education for girls. So there was even a social norm in my village, in the whole countryside actually, that girls only study until year seven. So after year seven, girls don't have to go to school, but boys can have that opportunity. And of course, education wasn't really something big for every families because everyday life was a survival day. It's not about education. It's about, you have to work on the farm, raising all the kids up. So the families just not prioritize it. So for me to see my uncle who worked really hard to become a teacher and then trying to teach us that education is the best way to break poverty, and simply by bringing us all the books and the magazines, I always look at him and was like, one day I want to become him. The second person who I didn't want to become, honestly, is my mom. I love her so much. She is my hero. But I didn't, the reason why I say I don't want to become as her, because her life was so tough. She has sacrificed so much, and she has that kind of resilience. That she can always, she would always toss us that because we were so poor, we can't talk, we can't fight, we can't argue with anybody. We just need to live a silent life. We can't dream. So, but she is the kindest person. She is the most amazing woman I would ever think of. Like growing up, I would learn how she have went through life by herself, raising three kids up. And she has always been the source of motivation for me to try hard to help her and also to be as kind as her. Like she had never had a great education, but she would be the best person who tell me how economic work, just because simply by the way of how she calculated everything in her life that, from a very meager incomes, basically from the Harvard seasons. So I didn't even realize it until I went to Australia and did my study and in my micro macro economic lecturers, my lecturer would say to me like, "You got to call your mom and thanks her." So I think she is just amazing and she is definitely my hero as well. But I would always try to see, what part of her is that I don't want to become. I want to fight for my life. I want to be the woman that have freedoms that can decide my life. Of course, her opportunity were very different. The way of living was different. Her life was different. But yeah, she definitely is my hero and my uncle.
So it's interesting, Hong, you're just talking about, like, often with careers, we know what we don't want to do, but we often don't know what we do want to do. I'm interested in, like, when you reflect on your career to date, right from your first job when you were age 13, right through to now. Tell me, what do you think was the most important career decision that you made?
I think, of course, when I was 13 years old, I had no choice. But looking back, I have to thank my mom for the courage to send me to Henry City because that changed my life, even though it was rough. But if I didn't have that step, I would still stay in the village. I might have my granddaughter by now. So there was so many moments that I would think that was so important to me. But I think the moments that I stepped into the soil of Hanoi, I have never been there, was the time that really changed my life. Being a babysitter and also the moments that I decided to go back to school and fought for it. That led me to a lot of opportunities. And also the time when I decided to go to Australia, because as a young woman at the age of 26 in my village, they all have kids. All of my friends would have kids at that time, got married. And for me to go to school again, that sounds really ridiculous. But I made that decision. And then it led to a lot of opportunities. And also when I was a waitress in Vietnam, I decided to go back to Cô Tô because I want to work in a different area. And then one day I decided to, when I first came back to Cô Tô, I was a receptionist. And then just by chance, I met a marketing manager at Cô Tô and I talk a lot with her. And one day she needed someone in her team urgently. I show up. I say to her, "Let me help you for 1 month." And then she randomly said to me, like, "I love to have you as a marketer in my team." And I was freaking out. I was saying, I have no idea what marketing is, but I want to try." So that changed my whole career opportunities because otherwise I would still work as a receptionist. So when I went to Australia, that also helped me to study in business. But another milestone that I found very fascinating when I completed my master in Melbourne. And for an international student to get a formal job in Australia, it's not that easy, especially a job in IT or in office. Usually international student would work in, being a waitress, working in the restaurant, and then of course getting a job without a permanent residence in Australia is really hard. But I would always prepare for it very carefully. So one day I got a job in an IT company as a business analyst. And during my uni life, three things I didn't like, or I would say I really hated, is finance, banking, and technology. And I became a business analyst working for an IT company that provide application for banks for financial institution. So it seemed like I always chose a path that it was really unknown. I didn't know what lines up before. But one thing I always said that I can learn. I pitched myself in the interview. I said to my boss back then, I said that, I don't have background in this area, but one thing I can confidently say is that I have good communication skill. I have a growth mindset and I can learn. So I became a business analyst without even knowing what business analyst meant. I still remember I heard about that position and I immediately also said that no, I don't want to apply because I don't like it. But then I realized that would give me a lot of opportunities. So I asked my host family, Uncle Rhys, what does business analyst mean? And he explained to me, I completely had no idea about what it was. I only said to him that, but this company will provide me an opportunity to stay here. And he said, give it a go. So that's how I applied for my job and I got it. And I think another important aspect for me, another important milestone was when I decided to go back to Vietnam. So, having a really good job living in Melbourne City, having an amazing host family, Australian family, and suddenly decided to go back to Vietnam. It seemed very like work to a lot of people, but I wanted to fulfill my mission with Koto, and that was the best decision, I would say. I grew so much during that time. So I came back to Koto and worked for Koto as an international partnership and engagement director. So I had so many milestones. I don't know what to fill in, but I always know that at some stage of my life, I always know that I wanted to stop the job. I wanted to find something else that interests me. I wanted to learn something else. So that was really important to really try out, try this, try that, and know that it fits you or it's not fitting you. Some of my jobs, I didn't like it at all, but I knew that those are the skills that I can also transfer as well.
So many important career decisions that you made.
Thank you.
Not just one, so many there. Richira, do you have anything to want to add there?
Actually, I had a follow-up question, and this is something that Hung Yud said earlier about, first deciding to trust Jimmy and join Koto. I guess my question was why did you decide that, initially you had some reservations and then you said that okay, I'm going to go ahead and trust Koto and trust Jimmy. And I'm asking this because and this is really going back to the story that you were sharing earlier, but you mentioned that you had a hard life and potentially you may have had situations where you were let down. So at that stage, to go ahead and trust somebody and it worked out great for you. Koto changed your life. But what was it that caused you to trust Koto and take this, kind of collaboration forward?
That's an amazing question because, I was so nervous and I was always saying no to a lot of things because I wasn't treated very well. So for me to trust Koto, it took a lot of courage. The first thing I was checking out Koto, I came in, but I still remember that I rode my bicycle to Kodo and I saw the signage and I stepped back. I was just trying to breathe. And I was so nervous, but I took all the courage that I have and I went in. I came into the office and the first person I met was a security guard, and he was so kind. He was so kind. He talked to me like a normal human. And then he called out a HR admin and she came to meet me. And she explained to me the process. And that was the first person that talked to me in that kind of kindness. And she just by her explaining the process of application to Coro to become a trainee, I said that I will be here. This is the place for me, because I just feel like just by meeting two people, a security guard and a HR admin, that have given me that kind of feeling of safetiness, the feeling of being welcome, the feeling of being, a human. So that is how it wasn't about Jimmy at the first stage. I only trust Jimmy when I came into the program and met him. But at the beginning, it was really the people that in the front line every day that dealing with people who, with kids who come in who are, so vulnerable, so low self-esteem, but they give that kind of first big smile and a warm welcome to the program. And so every day I was praying. I had never prayed for anything that much. I was always praying that I will get into the program. And every single day I try to save my money. Back then there was no mobile phone, so I had to go somewhere for the telephone service and call every single day to ask for the result. So you can see how much hope I have put in that one opportunities.
So you said you came back from Australia to join Koto in the organization. And then how did the story move forward after that?
So it's funny. I always wanted to be in Australia, and just one day I randomly say, Jimmy always being very close with me and very close with my family as well. And to me, he's a brother, he's a mentor, he's a teacher, he's a father. So I always talk with him, like whatever advice I need, I always talk with him. And he always wanted to have me back in Vietnam and at Koto. And during my time study in Australia, he would always say to me, like, I think it's time to go home. And I always said to him, like, oh, maybe 2 years. I wanted to spend 2 more years here working to get experience. And then one day I just said, within that same week, I said to him, we need to have a coffee. And he said to me, are you coming home? So I proposed to him that I wanted to come back. And these are the kind of things that I want to work in the organization. I volunteered for Kodo for 5 years during my time in Australia. So there wasn't any disconnection between me and Kodo and Jamie. But coming back to Vietnam was a huge step. And to be honest with you, the first 3 months, I didn't like it much. The environment being away from home for quite a while, and working in the organizations that, dealing with street kids and disadvantaged youth every single day. I wasn't working in the program, but I worked with partners. The job was amazing. I had chance to meet so many amazing people and partners and working on a lot of exciting projects. But the living environment and the culture of workplace were very different to me already. So the first 3 months I tried to like, oh my God, I need to really find a way to, adapt myself into this kind of, not new but also new. My life was always hectic, always busy. So I manage a team in Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City, and I also work with our board of directors in Australia. And I travel way too much. Like 1 year I would travel internationally, and domestically would be like 40, 50 flights per year. And then I started loving it so much, and I got really workaholic. And I just spent way too much time on working, and I grow so much. I mean, if you imagine like my roots, my traditional education is very, it's very like I always study when I was an adult already. So a lot of things could be very difficult. But going back to Kodo and working for them, seeing the trainees that, you know, change every single day, that was the best thing. Because I work in the position where I have to sell stories to raise funds for Kodos. And seeing that kind of impactful change every single day give me so much motivation and inspiration. And also I was sitting in the committee, recruitment committee for trainees. So I would interview hundreds of trainees from the south of Vietnam for their opportunity to come to study at Kodo. And every time doing it, it reminded me of myself, was sitting in that table, feeling very nervous, very vulnerable, very low self-esteem. And now I'm here interviewing someone like me and giving that opportunity to someone and also like making hard decision. You know, if I take this person in, that changed his or her life. But if I take them off, then you know, how did it feel? So it was a really exciting job. It was always busy, but I grow so much because I had the opportunity to learn so much, to be working on a lot of projects. That 2.5 years really helped me to see the world bigger and also traveling the world as well. Yeah, so it worked out perfectly.
It's an amazing story, you know, from a street kid living under a staircase to flying internationally 40, 50 times a year and domestically as well. You know, it's really inspirational. And you talked about your mother's courage, and you know, you certainly showed courage there. I'm wondering, when you interviewed those potential trainees to join Koto, what were you looking for in them?
So there were, of course, criteria that set for the interview, but it's always you need to dig in a lot of information to really learn about that person. So for Koto and for myself as well, the biggest investment is in the human, it's human capital investment. So the set criteria would be the ability to learn, their background check, the motivation. And also the last thing that very difficult, but we need to know the sense of giving back to Kodo, to their family, to the community. How can you assess all of that with that one person that used to live on the street or live in the village, and now you ask them those questions? It's really hard to really kind of get it, but somehow we need to. To we need to know about it to be able to make the decision, make informed decision. And for me, it's always start with storytelling, with conversation. You know, how can we create? I always refer back to the conversation I had with the security ward when I came to Kodo and the HR admin. How do I make this person feel so that they can be open enough and trusted me to talk about stories that is so devastating, to talk about stories that they can be vulnerable. I remember I interview a younger, like usually our interview was always 30, 45 minutes. And she took me 2 hours and we just both quiet. So how can you hold that space for someone to be in your space and kind of being open? Created that space has, you know, has been so fascinating to be able to learn from that person. And it just naturally flow with the conversation and you kind of get it. And for me, I look into a person, what I look for in a from a person is a drive, is a kindness, you know, is a drive to say my life was so bad, but I want to change now. And I needed help. I wanted to change. So, and the kindness would appear when, you know, you ask different situational questions that they can see how you can see how they deal with it. Because for us, it's not just about this is an opportunity, come in and study and then I'm done. Bye. It's all about how can I take this opportunity, but also, you know, become the change agent for somebody else? And how can I deal with another 100 of trainees living in the same place? So we had to put a lot of situational questions in the interview, but for me, kindness and the drive that can change lives is really important.
You know, Hung, in your story, there is this unique thread that's running where you take a path, but the exit is still foggy. You don't know basically the path that you're walking on. What are you walking towards? You don't really know, and things are uncertain. I'm just curious. I mean, and this has been playing again and again in your life. So first of all, why do you think you're wired this way that, you know, these kind of decisions, they are not challenging for you? Because to a lot of us, they are. It's not an easy decision to make.
I think I keep a very open mind for whatever that comes to my life. And I mean, as we grow, there are still a lot of uncertainties. If we look carefully, like within the world, in a very macro context, you know, we never expected to have a war. We never expected to have COVID, you know. So refer back to our daily lives. There was just so many things that can change. And it's constantly changed. So you just, I usually be very open, but I'm also be very mindful. I practice mindfulness, and I would always think that, you know, things can change for the better. If things are challenging, I knew that it's only challenge at that time, you know, it will pass. And I accept the fact that, you know, this is a really tough time. This is a really tough decision to make. And I can only make the decision that seemed to be right at that time. I remember one time I had to make a very difficult situation to exist someone in my organization, like someone who was also a friend. And so I asked my mentor before doing it. And he said to me, like, well, this decision is right at this time. Maybe 2 years later or 5 years later, you look back, you would say, I could do a lot better, or I could do differently. But at this moment, there is no other option. You just only you have to do it right at this time. So, you know, for me, every path that I took seemed to be very challenging. But I also am an optimistic person. I would always say, it's difficult now, but in the next year, I will be thankful for whatever I do today and whatever I tried today. And I'm very positive. I always think about kindness. I always think about, you know, if one thing that is not, that is challenging, that happening to you, something bad happening to your life, maybe that is a lesson that the universe tried to teach you. So instead of being a victim and saying, why is it me? Why my life is so suck? Why all of these bad things come to my life? I would always say, okay, maybe this is a challenge that the universe want me to learn. I need to learn quick so that I can graduate quickly and learn the next session. So every part that I do, I would always think the consequence of that. And if I have to learn some lesson, I would feel like I have to learn it, and I will not regret it, because it still become part of me. It still become lessons for me to learn. So I don't know if that answered the questions.
No, no, it does. It does.
So Hong, earlier you mentioned that when you were younger, your uncle and your mum were the heroes of your life for different reasons.
Yeah.
What about today? Who are your heroes today?
I think if I can say, there are a lot. But I also know that the hero in my story is not myself. The hero in my story are the people that help me, and the people that I can look up to, and the people that give me motivation and give me the meanings of life. Jimmy Pham, the founder of Koto, has always been, since I came to Koto, he's always my hero, who not just only gave me an opportunity, but who spent a lot of time and witnessed with me through the journey. And he would always, even when I was a trainee, I love learning English. And I would always, as soon as I finished Koto, I already said to him that I want to go and learn English. And he would say, focus on your job now, and then I will give you an opportunity to go to do your English training in an international language training center. When I was studying at Koto, every week I would see him and I would say, I want to go to university. And he is the only person at that time would always trusted me, saying, I will help you. He would never question, like, why are you going to do your study at university? He would always immediately say, I will help you. He would always trusted me wholeheartedly. But he also knew that at that time, I was very low self-esteem. He never thought that one day I would graduate from Koto because I was so low self-esteem. I would cry a lot. And then, being able to work closely with him, understand him better, his challenge, and the lives that he had sacrificed to do something bigger than himself has set a huge admiration for me. I saw him and I was like, I can do so much more to help him, to help Kodo, to create impact. So he's really a hero to me. And also throughout the journey of my social entrepreneurship, he would always help me a lot with advice. I remember after 1 month opening Hopbox, I texted him. I said to him, this is so hard. Hats off to you. I knew how hard it has been for you at Kodo, but not until now I opened my own organization. And I just want to close it down in the first month. And he said to me, there is no shortcut. You have to go through this. You have to learn all these lessons. Even if I say to you, like, oh, it's hard or it's easy, I can't say it. I can only say this is the lesson you have to learn, and it will pass. So I think being positive and optimistic, I actually learned from him. And then, I remember when I had to make a very tough decision after 2.5 years working for Koto when I returned back. It was a tearing, shocking tear, tearing conversation when we had to talk about my departure. And I said to him, I wanted to do something else. So I actually went to the UK to work. And I remember he said to me, I have my dream and you have your dreams. And I want you to make your dreams happen. But I know that every road will lead you home, because we love you so much. And something like that really always give me so much energy. And I remember, even now, as I am a grown-up woman, he still wanted to drop me at the airport wherever I went. If he had a chance, he would always say, oh, let me take you to the airport. So he dropped me off at the airport when I went to UK. And he gave me two things. Number one was a watch, and with a simple message saying, it's time to see what is out there. And then the second thing he did, he was trying so hard to get me a book called A Little Woman. So he would always understand me more than I understand myself. And even I live in New York. The minute that he knew that I moved to New York, he would say, I will come and visit you. So he would came all the way from Vietnam to New York to spend his birthday here with me, which is just so, so kind. And it's just like a really special relationship that I see someone I admire so much, but also someone I can talk shit with him. I can be so close with him in a way that we can talk about different kind of things. He's really a hero to me in so many ways, in so many aspects. He helped me a lot throughout not just professionally life, but in my family, that when situation happens, he would always advise me. He was friends with my brother, my late brother, and is friends with my sister now. They chat all the time. And so it's just so amazing how he has that capacity to do all of that. And for me, I feel so lucky. And I think the second group of heroes, I would say heroes, that really motivated me every day are the women at Hope House. For me to see how they have gone through and being able to change their lives, it's just so incredible. And those are the women who, fought for their lives in a very dangerous situation of violence. And now seeing them, it is not that they came in and their life changed. It took so much effort. I remember the other day I woke up with an email from my team sharing internally about a story of a woman who came in, but also help us understand that this is a situation that we need to be mindful when we deal with her, a woman who have to leave her son in a foreign country and came back to Vietnam and for 7 years couldn't see her son and being very violent by her husband, and she just didn't have a job, so she can't have the right to have her son. And seem a very simple thing that could trigger her was she came in her box, and on the first day we had a very happy meals lunch, and after that she was just soaking tears because it triggered her. It reminded her of her, one time happy life that she had with her family. So it took a lot of those moments to be able to change life. And for me, those are the heroes that keep me going every day, that I know that I need to do something bigger and better so that their lives could be changed.
I might
Well,
move on to the next question. Or you got a follow-up,
no,
Richard?
I don't have a follow-up. I was just going to ask, what is next for you? It's just been such a fascinating journey for you.
I want to work in education. And what next for me is always Hope House, but to take Hope House to the next level to where it is now. So I want to change the context of gender-based violence in Vietnam. So for me to be able, after this time, this amazing time of living and learning in Columbia University, I kind of knowing where my next thing is, the next bigger things is to implement program and design program to support the young women's and young people in general in Vietnam to learn more about the issues of gender-based violence so that they can avoid. I want to do preventative program in Vietnam, so to also hopefully expand Hope House in the next, in different countries. I want to focus a lot more on business as well, for the organization to be sustainable. So what Hope House do is to one side is a social enterprise that we have a production kitchen where we produce all the hampers and all the corporate gift box that made by our women, and then we sell it to generate income. So being able to learn the skills from here and apply it to the organization in Vietnam is really important for me. But next step for me, I think I would say always say Hope House. Yeah.
I would love to hear what is the best career advice that you have ever been given?
Oh my God, this is so hard. I think the best career advice I was given was by Jimmy again. I was going to study a hospitality degree. And then he said to me, like, you go and ask another 10 people to see if that would be something you wanted to do after study. And so I asked a lot of people because it was a full degree scholarship in Sydney instead of doing a diploma in Melbourne. And everyone would say to me, go and do that degree. I came back and said to him, I would choose to do a degree in hospitality, and he said that that is not a wise decision. And he would say to me, I can see that you will be working in public relation, you will be working external with external stakeholder, you will be working on big project in marketing communication, but you need to learn, so and you need the tools. And with every phase of my life, he would always advise me. He would always say, even when I made decision to come back to Vietnam to work in Vietnam, he would say, I don't see that you will come to Vietnam and live forever. You will be a global citizen. And these are the things that you will learn throughout your career. So he has always been my great advice to, number one, choose the best career that has impact and that I can devote my life to, something that I love, but also something challenging, something that I can constantly improve myself, not just like I get a job and then I get a salary and then I work for the rest of my life. But he would always advise me to look for something that is more challenging, more exciting. number two advice he would always give to me is, you know, you work on something that is bigger than yourself. And so there will be, of course, a lot of challenge. And it's not about the challenge. It's about how you deal with it and how you learn from it. Learn the lesson quickly so that you can grow faster. And I think number three advice would always, you know, being open-minded, having a growth mindset, and constantly learning. And you can learn from so many people, not just your boss or your, you know, the very top people in the industry that you can learn from. You can learn from, you know, a cleaner lady in the business, how she does her work, how she designs her schedule. So I think having those kind of advice really helped me see that, you know, how can I design my career to the level that I know that this is something that I can work on now, but also something can change in the future. How can I equip myself, my skills, my network? Like, always have someone to, you know, to share. How can I build the resources, the network of support? How can I seek for mentors? It's all contributed to a greater and better career that I wanted to do. So I think that the best advice that he would always given me, I do something, but also knowing that it's going to change.
All right, Richard, do you want to do the wrap up?
Sure. So Felicity, we're almost at the end of our episode. Any final words that you would want to share with our listeners? Because we don't just have the career practitioners who listen to the podcast. We also have a lot of job seekers and young people who listen to it. So any final words of wisdom, any motto you live by that you would want to share?
Thank you. I think I would say for young people who are about to pursue their careers, be really mindful about, you know, how you can contribute to the industry, not just how you can get it, but how can you contribute? What are your skills? What is relevant to the industry now? Are your skills relevant to what the employers seek for? And also building the networks, because jobs is not just online. I learned from my throughout my career, you know, job opportunities often be at a conversation, at a networking event, is happen when you know some person in that organization. And the job advertisements that put on LinkedIn on different job boards are actually might be the last thing that people put on. When I do recruitment, I will talk to my friends first if they have some referrals. So be very mindful about building the networks and continue to nurturing the networks, and also making your skills relevant to the job itself. And one thing I think is really important is that you have to have that kind of ability to unlearn and relearn the skills, because I think the hardest thing is to learn how to learn. There are things change, like things could change so quickly, especially given how fast the technology is these days. So you have to be able to adapt with it and to learn about it and build a relationship with people that you know that you need in your life and in your career. But also don't be transactional. You know, everything is about building relationship. Is not about, I need a job, I know that you can give me a job and I build a relationship with you. It's not about it. It's about a long-term relationship that you know that you can be friends with. You can, even like professionally, you still need to have those kind of networks. So networks is very important. Skills is very important. and having the ability to continue learning the new skills to be able to adapt with the change and set the goals. You know, when are you going to start to do another degree? When are you going to do your master degree? What kind of certification do you need to serve your role? So a lot of skills, a lot of things, but I would say, you know, being very open-minded and keep learning.
Wonderful. Thanks again, Hung. You have such an inspiring story. I'm sure our listeners would appreciate your sharing very much. So thank you so much for sharing it with us. And thank you, Felicity, for joining me today as well. Thanks so much, both
Thank
of
you,
you.
Tara.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Great to hear your story, Hung. And, you know, courage and kindness. You're really so inspiring. So I really appreciate your sharing your story today.
Thank you so much.